Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Mark Rotenberg for Petitioner Electronic Privacy Information Center. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
In February of 2009, the Secretary of Homeland Security authorized the deployment of full-body scanners as the primary screening technique in U.S. airports.
What does it mean to be the primary technique?
It's a determination that's made by the agency when the passenger goes through the security area of the airport as to which passengers will be subject to a closer inspection of their belongings, of their person. Typically, it's based on some predicate fact that might give rise to the primary screening. It can also be done on a random basis. The decision that the Secretary made in February of 2009 was to take the body scanners that up to that point in time had been used as an alternative for secondary screening and to, in effect, begin the process of requiring that they be used for primary screening for all passengers in the United States.
But I thought all passengers had the option, instead, if they didn't want to do that, of having a pat-down.
Government contends that there is an option for passengers, but one of the key elements of our case is that in the pursuit of Freedom of Information Act request, we obtained hundreds of documents of traveler complaints that indicate that many of the travelers, in fact, were not told that there was an alternative, that there was inadequate signage, were encouraged to go through the body scanners. So as a practical matter, that alternative did not exist for them.
It is also because it's not adequately publicized?
It's not adequately publicized, but reading the traveler complaints in the joint appendix, one also gets the sense that the TSA strongly disfavors the pat-down as the alternative.
Well, let's stay with publicized first. There's an exchange of letters between you and the department in which the department says, thank you, we've taken your suggestion about putting up or increasing the size of the sign or something like that, and have done that. At your suggestion, right? So there's some sort of a sign.
Yes, there is a sign. There was not a sign originally,
but
the sign has to be visible to the passengers, and the passengers have to feel that they can act upon the sign. In other words, if they're directed toward a line that leads them to the body scanner at the point that they're being asked by the security official to now go through the body scanner, the sign then becomes in effect irrelevant. They would have to protest the procedure that is already underway, which would lead them through the body scanner. In fact, this is what Schneier describes in the declaration that was attached to our opening brief. It was his experience at the Boston Logan Airport, where the government claimed that there was an option to go through the pat-down. He found himself simply being directed through the body scanners, as were others.
But did he request something else?
He did not request the alternative. He wasn't aware of it at the time. He became aware of it afterwards.
When was that?
That took place in September of 2009. I believe that's when the Schneier entry to Logan occurred. But
and when was the exchange of letters in which the department said they put up the signs?
I believe the way the agency referred to this decision was in response to our second petition.
That was in 2010.
Yes, that's correct, Your
After
Honor.
After your man
that's right.
Had
because
a problem. So we can put his particular problem aside.
Well, I don't think we can, in fact.
You had a problem. You asked them to put up signs. They said, okay, we've done that. Have you got any problems since then?
Yes, because the traveler complaints demonstrate that the travelers are not aware of the alternative, that they feel that they're required to go through the body scanners, and that as a practical matter, this is in the joint appendix at 417, 419, 421, they describe the pat-down search as coercive and retaliatory. Which I think leads passengers to believe that this is not a meaningful option. It's important to understand, though, that there are three distinct APA claims before the court.
Excuse me
yes.
a second. Is the patent, before there were AITs, if that's what these are called.
Yes.
Before there were AITs, there were metal detectors and pat-downs. Right?
Yes, that's correct.
And is there any reason to think that the pat-down procedure has changed?
There has been discussion of the changes in the pat-down procedure post December 25th. It's been described as an enhanced pat-down.
Just last December 25th?
Yes, that's correct.
That's after you.
That was after the trouser bomber incident. And those
but that's after the record was closed, too.
Yes, that's
so in the record, is there any suggestion that the pat-down became more intrusive than it had been before there were body scanners?
I think the record reflects that the pat-downs were intrusive while the body scanners were present in the airports. In fact, these are the documents.
But no suggestion of a change in the pat-downs?
Not directly, although I think the traveler experience would vary from instance to instance, so that some may have seemed less intrusive, others may have seemed more intrusive.
But the focus of your request to the department for rulemaking was on the implementation of the full body scanner.
Yes, that's correct.
Right? So if there was a pat, if you could do the metal detector or the pat down, and they changed matters, so now you could do the full body scanner or the pat down, and the pat down, if is the pat down is a real alternative, then no one's coerced into doing the full body scanner, and no one is deterred by a change in the pat down procedure to make it an unrealistic choice or more intrusive choice.
It may be the case that that outcome could have resulted, but that would not have obviated the need for the agency to undertake a public rulemaking when it made a substantial change in agency practice. It is our
view.
But
if it's agency practice, practice is specifically exempt from the rulemaking requirement.
Well, not if they exceed their legislative authority, not if they've
amended their rule. That's neither here nor there. The statute says procedures or internal organization and practices are exempt from rulemaking. Right? So whether it exceeds the statute is a different matter altogether. If it's a practice, it's not subject to notice and comment rulemaking.
Yes, but at the time the Secretary issued the decision, which was captioned an action memo, she was in effect stating that body scanners would become the primary screening technique.
Right.
And the agency, in response to our petition, which asked for public rulemaking on that, and which also asked that the program be suspended until there was, in fact, that public rulemaking, simply failed to act on our petition. So one of the APA claims here is that the agency had an obligation to respond to our 553E petition and failed to do so.
You could have dealt with that by filing a petition here for a writ of mandamus.
It's possible, Your Honor, we might have done
and,
that.
And their May 28th letter essentially responds to it, doesn't it? Doesn't the May 28th letter from the department essentially respond to both of your letters?
Well, the May 28th letter is interesting, actually. It treats our second petition, the one that was submitted in April in 2010, as if it was a request for rulemaking. But, of course, by that point, what we were seeking was the suspension of the program. And the reason that we had made that request was because we had become aware of the technical specifications and the design of the device. We do believe that the deployment of these devices leads to an unreasonable search and implicates statutory rights.
Let me try to get at the question Judge Ginsburg was asking you in a slightly different way on the notice and comment question. The government says that the SOP is an internal procedural rule. And as I read our cases, they seem to say that procedural rules remain procedural even if they have an impact on the public, as long as they don't impose any new obligations on the public and or on the regulated community. And as I see this, the major, you tell me what's wrong with this, the primary obligations that passengers have, namely to go through security before they can visit the sterile areas of the airport, and the obligation not to require to take explosives with them, that comes from the statute and the regulation. So that hasn't changed. I mean, even after this, you have to go through screening and you can't take explosives. So the way I read our cases, this looks procedural because it doesn't impose any new obligations on the regulated community. Do you disagree with my reading of the cases?
Well, I disagree to the extent that the use of this technique to achieve that goal, and we don't disagree, of course, as to the goal, but the use of this particular technique implicates rights that previous practices of the agency did not.
Well, do we have any cases that say that when we're looking at a notice and comment question? That's my question. I mean, we have lots of cases that are procedural where agencies change procedures that obviously have a major effect on the public, but they're still procedural. So what's different about this one?
Well, Your Honor, I think in the circuit, of course, I mean, Alaska Hunters is significant because it speaks to the question of what happens when an agency changes through regulation its practices, and the extent to which that's a substantial change has legislative impact. Yeah. It's not merely the interpretation of a rule.
Right, but that case didn't involve the question of whether it was procedural. So, I mean, for example, how do you distinguish this case from American Hospital? There was a situation where the HHS rules for peer review of hospitals was quite extensive. Yet, since it didn't change the fundamental requirements of the statute, namely that hospitals provide quality, non-fraudulent care, we said it was procedural.
The change here is the exercise of agency authority that in the first instance we don't believe the Congress anticipated, because we look in fact at the history of the relevant provision, 44925, and we see the use of this particular technique, which is discussed in the history, as a pilot program that the agency will test and deploy. And the Senate committee language, in fact, anticipates that there will be a final determination before a decision is made to use these devices for primary screening. So we believe that the Congress had identified the fact that this would be a change in agency practice. Moreover, when the public became aware of the intent of the agency to
that may mean that the SOP is arbitrary and capricious or violates the statute. But my questions had to do with whether notice and comment was required.
Well, we think the notice. Yes, I understand.
Yeah.
We think the notice and comment would have been required at the time the agency changed the screening technology for passengers. And this relies in part on the nature of the technique. You see, to the extent that the circuits have recently considered how far the screening of passengers may go in the airports, we believe that they have set out a standard that requires that these techniques be minimally invasive. That's what then-Judge Alito said in Hartwell for the Third Circuit in 2005, and that was also the view of the en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit in 2007 in Akai.
Those were Fourth Amendment cases, correct?
Right.
Yes, those were Fourth Amendment cases, but they concerned
about the notice and comment issue. See, I see your point. I mean, I get your point. Your point is that this new procedure, the use of these AITs, is far more, setting aside the question, the discussion you were having with Judge Ginsburg about the pat-down, but your argument is, I mean, I see your point. The AITs are far more intrusive than going through the magnetometers, right? That's your point. And far more intrusive into personal privacy. But what I don't see is where we take that into account in applying our case law on notice and comment. As I see that case law, it turns whether something's procedural or not turns on whether it imposes new independent obligations on the regulated community that don't come from the statute.
So if
that's what you need to help me.
Yeah. So if we don't persuade you on the obligation of the agency to have undertaken a notice and comment, you still would have the authority to require that the rule be set aside under 7062 A, B, or C. I mean, it can be an abuse of discretion, it can exceed its authority, it can be contrary to law. So even if it were the case, although we believe that the agency should have conducted a public notice and comment, the public was certainly concerned. As to the rule itself, which is the change in practice that substantially implicates these other interests, there are a variety of reasons that the rule could be set aside.
Can I ask you about the procedure point? It seems to me, I don't know what my colleagues would say, but if TSA instead had said, we are going to now employ strip, everyone has to strip. Now, that may be a procedure, but I don't think My colleagues would say that doesn't impose a new obligation on the public.
I see my time has expired. May I answer?
Pardon me?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've got a couple other questions.
Yeah, well, this is... Yes.
And so I don't see that this procedure, our procedure cases necessarily answer this case because of the privacy and Fourth Amendment rights of the public. And with respect to the option of the pat-down, you could also say, well, there's the option of just turning around and saying, I'm not taking this flight. And I don't think that is something that the public has to choose between. But my other question goes to something you said originally. Isn't it true that even though TSA is using this as a primary screening, that they are still, in their discretion, allowing travelers to go through the magnetometer first, and then, if something is triggered, go through the full-body scanner?
As to the last point, Your Honor, that decision, of course, remains with the TSA because they have set out a policy that would subject all travelers to primary screening if they chose to exercise that authority. The second point is significant as well because after a CAI, it seems to be the rule that consent may not be withdrawn. So once a passenger enters the screening area, they actually don't have the opportunity to pull back. And finally, the point which is so critical in this case is the nature of this change can't be ignored. It may be a procedural question as to whether or not the rulemaking is required, but the basis of that inquiry must at least consider that this is something more than changing the size of the bins. This is a very substantial change in practice that has widely impacted passengers, and many of them have objected to it.
You know, if we ended up, if you were right about this, wouldn't the agency just simply invoke the good cause exception and skip notice and comment?
Well, they did say that, Your Honor. In fact, in their brief, they suggest that if you were to find a rule and to require notice and comment, they might choose to assert that. We, you know, would contest it, and it could be a matter that could come before the court again. Uh-huh.
May it please the court, Beth Brinkman on behalf of respondents, and with me at council table are John Capel from the Department of Justice and Mark Pilcher from TSA. We submit, Your Honor, that the petition for review should be denied. And focusing on the APA issue, the claim should be rejected because TSA correctly determined that rulemaking was not required here, and that determination by the agency is required to the highest deference by this court under the American Horse Protection case. The APA rule does not apply here because the automated imaging technology at issue constitutes security measures that TSA takes at the direction of Congress. And Judge Henderson, I think this goes to one of your questions here. It's Congress that legislated this. Under Section 44925, Congress was very specific and directed the development and deployment of many things, but including, and this is the appendix to the red brief at the second page.
Suppose it's discovered in the next few months. Suppose a tragedy occurs and sometime in the next few months a terrorist gets through one of these AITs, okay, and blows up an airplane. And the government, the TSA, responds by saying, look, we're beyond our ability to handle this with technology. We're just going to require strip searches. We're going to have a new SOP, and we're going to require strip searches. No notice and comment?
I think you'd have a overwhelming Fourth Amendment claim, Your Honor.
No, I didn't ask you about that.
But no notice and comment. If I can explain why,
I think
that that evolving change is very key, and the flexibility for these security measures that demonstrate that it is an agency, not a rule, or if a rule, an agency practice that is not subject to notice and comment. And there are many signals for that. First, there's the fact that the very specific language of the statute that Congress enacted talked about deployment of equipment that can detect non-metallic explosives. Clearly, Congress is directing and telling TSA that they shall develop these under Section 44925A. They shall ensure that that equipment alone, and this next part's key also, or as part of an integrated system, can detect those kinds of explosives. And then in B of that subpart, Your Honor, when they directed TSA to develop a plan for this, Congress specifically referenced backscatter X-ray, which is automated imaging technology. So Congress did the legislative lifting here.
Are you saying that you're limited to a technological fix and that you couldn't do the strip search? I don't know where you're going with that.
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that's a Fourth Amendment issue, but it's not a notice and comment rulemaking here, because this is not a rule. These are security measures taken alone and in combination.
Well, Congress tells the EPA to control certain toxic substances, but it does so through rulemaking.
But we're talking about whether or not, for example, this was a substantive rule. It's not a substantive rule. It doesn't create any no new rights or duties. It's taken at the directive of Congress.
Are we talking about the hypothetical new rule? Judge Tatel's hypothetical?
Yes.
Okay, that's where it's no new obligations?
No, the legal enforcement for someone who does not comply with screening by TSA is already in place. It's under the statute and under the regulations. These are security measures that TSA implements to carry that out. They are subject to judicial review, no doubt about that. They are subject to judicial review here in this court. In fact, the Fourth Amendment and the Privacy Act claims are here before the court, and there is judicial review of that substantive claim, that substantive Fourth Amendment claim. But they're not subject to notice and comment. And another factor to take into account is the combination, how about these security measures interact with this layer in upon layer. For example, Judge Tatel, when you were saying that perhaps an explosive made it through this machine, there are many layers that a threat has to make through. And one of the flexibilities and one of the indicia that this is a practice of the agency is because they decide where, when, how, in what combination. The AIT technology is not at all of the airports.
I think your answer to my hypothetical is interesting. You're consistent. You're sticking to your principles here, and you may well be right that, you know, our case law, as I said to your to counsel for the petitioner here, you know, our case law does seem to make this question turn on whether it imposes any new obligations. But still, we do seem to look more deeply at the impact on the public. For example, in JEM broadcasting, that's the Hard Luck case.
Yes.
You know, the court said that our task is to identify which substantial effect are sufficiently grave so that notice and comment are needed to safeguard the values underlying the APA. So we seem to be asking just the question we're asking here, whether true this looks procedural and true it doesn't impose any new obligations, but yet the question is the impact on the regulated community so severe that it's the kind of thing that should require notice and comment?
Your Honor, in this context, we submit it not, for at least three reasons.
Do you agree that's an appropriate question for us to ask?
I think under the case law, no. I think under the case law, I think under the case law, we prevail. It's clear there's no right, there's no obligation. It's already set up and has already been legislated by Congress and through regulations of the agency through notice and comment.
But your point is that it's Congress that directed the use of these particular machines?
Well, in this particular case, yes, but it also directed a integrated system of security measures, and agencies also on the other side have to be able.
Didn't Congress just tell the agency to examine these AIT machines? And it didn't tell them to do it. Suppose the agency had concluded that the technology wasn't sufficiently developed.
Certainly, they
wouldn't
have
felt obligated by Congress to deploy the ATI, would it?
No, they have to give high priority, though, to developing equipment than to detect.
You can't look to the statute for a direction that AIT be the primary screening device.
No, Your Honor, but that is the legal framework that establishes the duties and obligations of TSA and of the traveling public and the regulation. Here, it is the at the same time, you can't hamstring the agency that has to have enough flexibility to take many security measures and put them in combination, who, what, where, when, how, on an ever-changing, developing basis. And I would say in the record, the GAO report
indicates hamstringing. The only question is whether for substantial changes, dramatic changes, like from magnetometers to full-body screening, notice and comment might be required.
We don't believe so, Your Honor. Judicial review, yes. Notice and comment serves a different function. I mean, it's concerned with substantive legislative rules, not interpretive rules. There are many exceptions to APA that would be substantive changes, Your Honor. Here it is a practice. It's a rule of practices, as you pointed out earlier. And part of that, I think, is important to understand the development also. The GAO report in the record indicates that there have been 10 different types of enhanced technology like this that TSA has had either in research, development, or deployment at various points in the past 10 years. The record is also very clear, Your Honor, that there is a new technology that will address many of the privacy concerns that have been here that is being piloted right now. It's called
ART.
Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor. It's the automated target recognition, the ATR. And there are several points in the record where, in fact, in the letter that we respond to last May of 2010, we point out we are developing. That's in different countries on the TSA website. There's a press release of February 1 that now is being piloted. And what that does, two things. It, for anyone who has an anomaly, the human figure is just a generic outline of a human figure with no particular features, and it can highlight where a particular anomaly is instead of having any kind of the privacy questions that are raised with the particular person's image. And also under that technology, if there's no anomaly, there's no kind of image at all. It's just passed through. Mm-hmm. So that, again, reinforces that TSA cannot have to stop every 5 minutes and do notice and comment rulemaking.
Well, no, it could invoke the good cause exception.
Well, Your Honor, I think they could on remand. I think that would be very bad precedent, Your Honor, because I think that the...
Isn't that what it's for?
Not in this case. I'll tell you another layer I think that's significant here. By regulation, this information having to do with screening is SSI, yeah. Sensitive security information. By regulation, I think that's another indicia that this is an issue of security measures in combination.
We're handling this case in public. Could do the notice and comment at the same level of generality?
I think that would be more difficult, Your Honor, because as you know, we have submitted SSI to you. We offered petitioner's counsel the opportunity to have access to SSI. That's authorized by regulation, but it's not for notice and comment
rulemaking. By the way, do you think that for the good cause exception, does that end it, or do you think an agency that invokes the good cause exception still has to go through notice and comment?
Oh, well, I think that ends it, Your Honor.
It does?
Yes, I believe so.
So then that makes me even less worried about the concerns you've raised about notice and comment. Rather than try to fit this case into these pigeonholes we have, you know, about whether this is procedural or not.
Well, Your Honor, I also wanted to point out the petitioner's kind of erroneous characterization of this change to using this as primary screening technology. From the very outset, Your Honor, as early as, I believe, January of 2008, in the very first privacy impact assessment that was put out, this is at JA 6 and 7, when TSA has been so forthcoming about what it's doing in this process, it talked in a sentence in the first paragraph explaining this pilot that was going to be starting, a subsequent phase will evaluate WIBI whole body imaging technology, earlier terminology, for individuals undergoing primary screening. And on page 7 of the JA, it explains in the very first line, by using passenger imaging technology, TSA expects to be able to quickly and without physical contact screen passengers during primary or a secondary inspection for prohibited items, et cetera. So
I still don't know what primary means.
Primary is the initial screening, and if there's additional screening that's needed, then you move to secondary screening.
If I misunderstood Mr. Rotenberg, it was something different, that it was that people are deflected into this if there's some reason for particular scrutiny.
That would be secondary screening. That's
my understanding. I may have misunderstood. So if the primary screening is the routine and the secondary is a pat down or perhaps even more, depending on what's revealed, what is the status of the purported alternative, that is to say, of having a pat down instead of going through the AIT?
That remains as an option for everyone. The signs that are in the record make clear that a person can opt out of AIT and have a pat down. There's no question about that.
Well, I just looked at three letters to Mr. Rotenberg, which Mr. Rotenberg referred me to, all of which said, or at least two of which clearly said, I wasn't aware of any or informed of any alternative. In one case, all lines except the one were shut down. So what do we make of that?
Your Honor, I can say that I've been informed that the number of complaints are an infinitesimal percentage of the travel and public. TSA has been very responsive, as you pointed out in a letter. They appreciated petitioner's input on one, and that was an instance where they put the sign right on the machine so you could see it again there.
Well, you're pretty well down the process at that.
Well, there's a map that shows that it can come earlier also, and they're different again.
Where's that?
I'll have to find it.
How big are the signs?
There are various signs, implementations, messaging, so that they can be aware of that. The I think important part to
you said that complaints are an infinitesimal
yes.
percentage, and of course, if they were anything else, you'd be overwhelmed. But what is the percentage that opt for the opt out? And
my understanding is about 3%.
Oh, so it's not so fanciful.
Is
that in the record? Is that in the record?
I believe so, Your Honor. I just want to clarify two things. You're asking me how many opt out as opposed to how many complain about signs. That's
yeah.
the yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'll get you the here we go. It is on the this is SSI. Right, it's in the SSI appendix at page 42. That's the map of where different signage appears. And again, I have to emphasize, Your Honor, this is why it's not subject to notice and comment.
Excuse me, that's SSI, where the signs are? I mean, if you want
to. By regulation, public, Your Honor, if under 49 CFR 1520.
Yeah. Does that make sense to you? Why, if you want the public to know about the option, would you classify it as SSI?
It's not, it's the location of the signs. When you're there, I think it's. Something that you have to understand that each airport is different. It has a different configuration.
I understand that, but the purpose of these signs is for people to read them and know about the option, right?
Right. So but, Your Honor, in order to tell people where the...
Why would it be SSI? I don't understand that.
I'm not sure. I can clarify for a minute whether this...
Does that make sense to you? No. You don't have to answer that.
Okay. Well, I think what I'm saying, Your Honor, is the sign is not... We're talking about layout, and I'm not sure whether that is in fact.
Is there a secret handshake?
Right.
Your Honor, TSA is tasked with a very, as I know the court well knows, a very serious responsibility.
What about the 3%? Is that in the record? You're on the signs. Answer that.
I'm sorry. Yes. I've been informed that this particular documentation, SSI has been removed from, and it is not SSI that's in the record. So that's at the page 42 of the supplemental appendix.
I believe that just happened in response to my question.
No. No, Your Honor,
really
I can assure you not.
That's one of the fastest responses I've ever had from an agency.
I wasn't sure we were going to be just talking about a lot of maps of signs today.
You have to be nimble, you know.
I want to shift back to the APA.
Before you shift.
3%.
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
Where is that in the record?
I don't believe it is in the record.
Okay.
That's what I've been informed
by. Did you
want
to shift back to APA issues?
I wanted to say three things about the APA. I wanted to make clear that there's no 706 claim here. This is
That's
simply.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah,
there
none.
Was one, right? Okay.
Okay. Just to make that clear, gotcha. It's a notice and comment rulemaking.
Right.
And our view is it's not a rule. If it is a rule, it clearly comes well within the heartland of this court's case law about.
What do you do? Really, We don't really need to decide whether it's a rule if we can decide it's not a legislative rule.
Exactly, Your Honor. Right. That's what I was getting to. It's in the heartland of the exceptions.
Judge Tatel's illustrated the distinctions within the realm of ruledom between or among rules, legislative procedural interpretive rules, is a bit difficult.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that these exceptions, in fact, overlap. We would submit that it's an agency rule of practice, and I think that overlaps with the general statement of policy.
In the reply brief, they cite a case called Dekus versus Board of Parole. How would you distinguish that from this case?
I'm sorry, I don't think I'm familiar with it, Your Honor.
Well, we ruled that parole guidelines were the government argued that parole guidelines were procedural, and the court rejected that. And it said that the exemption should not be construed broadly. Any action which goes beyond formality and substantially affects the rights of those regulated. And that's what it held.
Your Honor, that is so different because it affects the direct rights of someone to liberty. Here, the rights and obligations to submit to screening. But Your Honor, I think if you can...
Their whole argument here is that AIT is a dramatically different technology which affects the passenger's privacy rights.
But
that's their argument.
Use of these security measures did not change rights or obligations in the legal sense. Already under the statute and the regulation, the agency had the authority, the clear authority, to implement these security measures. Mm-hmm. And under the APA's framework, those types of rules of practice, I see I'm over my time, I can continue.
No, you keep going.
Thank you. Are not what notice and comment rulemaking are for. Moreover, there's a broad array of exemptions that ensure that agencies like TSA can carry out their missions, their critical missions to the country. And those exceptions, as set forth in repeatedly throughout court's case law, make clear that this is not subject to notice and comment. Yes, it is subject to judicial review. If the court would like, I can address that we believe the merits of the Fourth Amendment and the Privacy Act are here and should both reject it on their merits. We believe the other two claims are not properly before the court.
What other two?
The other two that are before the court is the Fourth Amendment claim.
No, you're saying there's some that are not before.
There are two.
The Video
Voyeurism Act and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The first one, there was not exhausted. The second one, there's no standing. But both on the Fourth Amendment and the Privacy Act, those are the kinds of challenges that can be brought through judicial review. We believe with or without merit, this is a reasonable administrative search, and they're weighing the governmental interest versus the tailoring and the privacy safeguards here is well within the case law. They're also in the Privacy Act. There's no system of records. There's no connection between anyone's name, ticket, nothing. The system for boarding passes is completely separate. It's not connected at all to the AIT. They cannot be connected, so there's no system of records here, and there was no Privacy Act violation. But on the core APA issue, I think it's a question here of the agency's response, its determination that rulemaking was not required, and again, this court has said that it is entitled to the highest levels of deference under the American Horse Protection Association case, and we think the legislative directive from Congress, the pre-existing regulations requiring the screening, the fact that these are security measures that are layered with other security measures that pre-exist, that may post-date, that it's an evolving look at technology and equipment as directed by Congress is always in favor of recognizing that notice and comment rulemaking was not required
here. What was the decision of the agency in the horse protection case to which we said there was so much deference?
That was a regulation about the treatment of horses because they were being abused in order to perform better with higher...
Right, and isn't that the agency declined to denied a petition, or I don't know, ignored, but didn't act on a petition to engage in rulemaking on that subject.
They had not wanted to redo rulemaking that had been there, and the court actually in that instance did send it back to the agency, but it set forth this standard of great deference, and we think that...
After which we then sent it back to the agency.
In that particular case, Your Honor.
So it was great, but not great enough.
Well, Your Honor, I think that when you look at the TSA's letter, as you mentioned, the May 28, 2010 letter, it explains why rulemaking is not required, and it goes through all of the petitioner's claims and sets that out.
I'd like to ask a question about this X-ray scanner, mm-hmm. and it may be in the record, but have you considered the frequent flyer? In other words, I know this is less than 2 minutes at a certain altitude and so forth, but somebody who goes through one of these, say 10 or 20 times a month, mm-hmm. an airline crew, for instance, that's a lot of exposure to an X-ray.
Actually, that is in the record, and it's
what is it?
Really minimal. There are two different technologies here for the backs.
I know.
Scatter X-ray.
I'm not talking about the millimeter wave.
For the X-ray, that is equivalent to 2 minutes of air flight time.
And what I'm saying is, that's fine for someone who goes through it once a year or once a month, but how about someone who goes through it twice a day, the airline crew, for instance?
Yes, Your Honor. There have been extensive studies by independent agencies, by the FDA. Yes, there are. Some of the reports are in a separate appendix because there was copyright issues, and there's a single-use copyright, so it's not a publicly filed appendix. That's a separate appendix from the SSI appendix.
Copyright.
That's right, Your Honor.
And is it in here?
Yes, there are studies in there, and there are other references throughout the record about the FDA study, the NIST study, and also Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory has done studies, and those are all against independently established standards, and they have looked at repeated exposure.
Will this tell me whether you make any exceptions for the crews, for instance, the people who go through these things daily or almost daily?
I don't believe it will, Your Honor. There have been changes to those processes also. It is part of the task of TSA and the flexibility that it needs to be able to do its job to be able to look at that and then reassess, for example, how pilots are treated. I had the moment there, Your Honor, to just pull out my regular appendix, and that map is it in the public appendix. The joint appendix at JA84 is the a map with signage. It depends, of course, what airport it is, but you can see where the different signs are posted, letting people know that the AIT technology is optional. They can opt out of it.
If we were to look at the specs, which are not before us, it would presume, would it specify the minimum size or the prescribed size of the sign and the number of meters from the AIT that it has to stand and so on?
Yes, there are all kinds of... obviously, specifications.
That's the locations vary, but the signage is standardized.
It's difficult to say standardized. I have to tell you, Your Honor, because even the machines aren't standardized because of different physical configurations of different airports. Obviously, not all airports have this. Less than 100 have it. And even then, it depends on a lot of factors about how the area can be structured and set up. So I cannot say that it is standard, that TSA is dealing with ever-evolving threats and ever-evolving circumstances. I mean, Your Honor, just having transformed the airports to put in this equipment to begin with, as you know, things that used to be lobbies are now screening areas. So I don't think it can be, say, it's standardized.
And what can you tell us about the pat-downs? Are the pat-downs that are used, that you can opt for, are they the same pat-downs that you used to get if you didn't go through a magnetometer?
There is one pat-down that is given now. At different times over the years,
everybody says they're much more intrusive now than they used to be.
And I can say there have been changes in the pat-downs. They're not at issue here,
But it is relevant in terms of the discussion Judge Ginsburg was having with your counsel for the petitioner. I mean, are you taking the position that, is the government arguing that we don't really even have to consider whether AIT is different because there's the alternative pat-down, and that hasn't changed?
I think that is a factor to consider in the Fourth Amendment analysis.
But it's not related to the notice and comment?
No. No, it's not, Your Honor. Okay. It is definitely related to the Fourth Amendment, and we believe that...
Because you could have argued that, right? You could have said... I mean, your point is there's no change here, right? And you could have... I mean, you could have said, look, until they deployed these machines, you went through a magnetometer, but you could choose a pat-down. Now they have AITs, but you can choose the same pat-down, so there's no difference. But you didn't argue that about notice and comment.
No, we wouldn't argue that, Your Honor, because their claim goes to the difference. The difference is that there is an image. It is blurred.
You're missing my point. There is no difference if both pre-AIT and post-AIT, you can opt for the same pat-down.
So you could opt for a pat-down. I have to say the pat-down has changed over time, Your Honor, in response to various threats. So I can't pinpoint particular points in time, and I believe it's changed on more than one occasion.
I understand. That's fine. But the bottom line for me is that the government is not arguing that this issue is relevant to the question of notice and comment.
I think that... I misunderstood your point. I thought you were saying there was no difference between the experience of an individual going through a metal detector versus an AIT. I completely misunderstood that. I think there is a difference, and it wouldn't be really reasonable for us to argue there wasn't a difference. But I do agree with you that the option of the pat-down has been there, and that is one of the factors that we have pointed to as one of the privacy safeguards. That there is that opt-out.
I understand that. You've answered my question. Thank you. Okay.
Great.
So, I'm not sure what the answer is. So, are you or are you not arguing that as long as the pat-down is a truly available alternative, there's no coercive or burdensome effect on the public of moving from magnetometers to AITs for primary?
We have pointed to that as one of the reasons that the concerns about privacy are, and the concerns of a substantive change are not of the magnitude and do not require notice and comment rulemaking. We would point to that.
You do?
Where
did you argue that?
No.
That was new to me today. Where did you argue that?
We talked about the flexibility and the combination.
Yeah, in your Fourth Amendment analysis. But I didn't. And in your whole first part of your argument here, you didn't even mention this. So
no,
now I'm really confused. When he answered my question, you said, no, you're not arguing. And then when you answered Judge Ginsburg's question, you said, yes, you are.
I answered a different question, Your Honor, when you asked it to
me.
I misunderstood it. I thought you were saying, why weren't we saying a machine or a pat-down equals a machine or a pat-down?
What?
And I said that wasn't really an appropriate...
Let me just say my question again, okay? The questions I was asking were, is there a difference to the public, the passengers, the traveling public, from the shift from magnetometers to AIT being primary? That's a relevant question. Now, one answer the government might give to that is, look, you don't really have to ask that question because when we just use magnetometers, you could have a pat-down. Now that we use AIT, you could have the same pat-down. So, in effect, there's no change.
I could go one step further than that, Your Honor, also, because there are still magnetometers. And
no, but
if you're in an airport that has both,
I know, in fact,
and you reject either, you get the same pat-down.
Okay, but all right, I'll try once more. You're not telling me that this is relevant to the notice and comment question, are you? Or are you? I understand your argument that it's relevant to the Fourth Amendment issue, but I don't recall anywhere in the brief where you argued this.
It's not in the brief, Your Honor, in this context, because our argument in the brief is that this does not affect any rights or duties because of the pre-existing legal structure. But if we go down the path of determining whether or not there are exceptions, I think you raise a valid point that we would embrace that would suggest if you're moving beyond kind of the heartland of the current precedent here and saying maybe we do want to move to look at the effect, as
well,
we had discussed before.
I didn't say we had to move beyond our precedent. I quoted you from JEM, which states exactly what I was asking. It only requires me to follow JEM.
Oh, Your Honor, we would suggest that the case law.
JEM Broadcasting, yeah.
Right. But when you look at American Hospital Association or the Amoco case or the Association of Irritated Residences case, those cases are all looking at whether or not there is a substantial duty or right that's changed. But if we're looking at just a change in some kind of impact on the traveling public, as you suggest, then this would become relevant. But that's three steps removed, I think, from what our argument was in briefing. But I see as you bring it up here, that is a very valid point, and I want to reinforce that they get the exact same pat-down because they would go to the same
Well, no, you told me earlier that you thought the pat-downs have been changing.
They have changed, Your Honor.
There are two ways that you've addressed the pat-downs. One is there's been there's been a difference over time. Right? The other is at any one time, they're the same, whether that's what you opt for or that's the only thing available at that airport.
Right. If you are at an airport and you opt out of a metal detector or an AIT today in March of 2010, you get the same pat-down. A year ago.
In either place.
Right.
But it's different over time as to what that same pat-down is.
Yes. Okay. But if a year ago, if you had opted out of one or the other, you would have gotten the same pat-down.
You'd still be standing in line.
At that time. But you get whatever the pat-down security measures were at that point in time. I apologize for my lack of clarity. I was, confused on the temporal.
That's okay.
It comes from teaching history, but not geography.
Yeah. If there's nothing further, Your Honor, thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to address the central question the panel has raised about the obligation to conduct the notice and comment rulemaking, and also the question that Judge Henderson raised regarding the X-ray exposure. And we think both of these concerns point to a case that is very much on point here, and that is Nader versus Butterfield, the 1974 case that answered the question whether a notice and comment rulemaking was required by the decision of the FAA to substitute X-ray inspection for physical inspection of carry-on baggage. Now, it's worth noting, not only did the court hold in that case that the notice and comment rulemaking was required and the FAA was not permitted to assert.
That was the district court.
Yes, it was the district court. That's correct. It was the district court. The district court held that the notice and comment rulemaking was required, but I think it's significant also to understand that moment in time when that decision was reached. In other words, the government has argued in this case that we are uniquely vulnerable. We have a post-9/11 mentality. We've come to understand that we need to accept greater intrusions into our private life. But what preceded Nader versus Butterfield is actually quite remarkable. There was a five-year period, 1968 to 1973, when there were 137 reported instances of attempted bombings or hijackings of planes within the United States. A bomb went off at JFK in 1972. The FAA administrator was very concerned, obviously, about airport security and had begun a public rulemaking in 1972. Subsequent to these additional acts, wanted to initiate this new procedure using the X-ray screening device for the carry-on baggage, and he sought to do so without the public rulemaking. That decision by the agency was challenged, and the district court ultimately said that the public rulemaking should be required. Now, we contend, of course, that given those circumstances, if a public rulemaking can be required for a change in a screening procedure which is less invasive, because this is the carry-on baggage
but
now.
But you see, the problem you have is that our case law, D.C. Circuit case law, if you just look at the cases, one right after the other, they seem to turn on whether or not the regulation imposes any new obligations. They don't look at this issue that you want us to look at and that I've been asking the government about, namely the impact on the regulated community. They just ask whether there's any new obligations.
Here,
and that, so that's what I'm trying to get you to help me with. That.
Here's the answer to that question, Your Honor, and the reason that we focus on the Secretary's February 2009 decision. Uh-huh. Because what the agency had told the public prior to that decision was that the use of this particular technique would be for secondary screening. It would be voluntary. It was an alternative, in fact, to the pat-down procedure, and the images would not be stored. That was how the public understood the screening procedure. That's how the agency described the screening procedure. Now, when the agency subsequently decides to make this significant change in its practices, we believe that that is the heart of the APA.
Okay, so what's your best case for that? What case do you think supports that? Other than a district court decision?
I'm sorry, other than the district court decision?
Yeah, the D.C. Circuit decision supports that proposition.
Well, again, we think it's a last, you know.
Or Supreme Court, I'll accept that too. Thank you.
You know, well, the cases that flow from Alaska Hunters. In other words, whether it's amending the prior rule because this is.
But was that? But did that case turn? I don't remember. Did that case turn on whether it fell into this exception for procedural rules of practice and procedure?
Well, we wouldn't concede that it's a rule of practice or procedure. We're arguing that it's a legislative rule, in effect, that the agency's taken upon itself to engage in an act that it wasn't
authorized. But what was the categorization issue in Alaska Hunters?
I believe in Alaska Hunters, the circuit determined that was, in fact, a legislative rule.
Did you cite this case?
Yes, this is 177 F3D 1030.
Where is it in the brief?
This is in our reply. No, it's not in our reply.
No, it's not in the blue. Well, it's not listed in the blue brief. Maybe.
Well, it is cited in the government's brief, Your Honor, at 34.
Probably for a different proposition.
Well, yes, I appreciate that. But the language is significant because here at 1034 in the opinion, the court said if the FAA now wishes to apply those regulations to these individuals, which is to say treating the hunters as pilots for commercial aviation purposes, the court goes on to say it must give them an opportunity to comment before doing so. The notice to operators was published without notice and comment, and it is therefore invalid.
So you would agree, I take it, that if the TSA develops improved software for the AIT equipment, and it's more sensitive and better able to detect dangerous materials, would that require notice and comment?
It may, Your Honor. Certainly, with respect.
What's the standard we would use to decide? But some things wouldn't, right?
I mean, yes, obviously.
They don't. I mean, you mentioned the question of the changing the kind of bins. That doesn't require notice and comment. So, what's the principle that we would use to distinguish between?
Part of the problem here, Your Honor, when we're talking about the image, there are actually two distinct inquiries. There's been quite a lot of discussion about the image that's displayed to the operator, and so we would certainly concede that an image that presents a generic figure and highlights areas that might require further inspection, in terms of the image that's displayed, that diminishes the privacy concern without question. But you see, what's driving our concern in this case is that these devices are designed to store and record the unfiltered image. In other words, they have the capacity.
But the government says that that's all disconnected, that can't be done.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, we've looked at this matter quite closely in the record. It's through the Freedom of Information Act that we obtained the technical specifications. They're in the joint appendix, one version.
Now, it has the capability of doing it, but the government tells us that functionality is is disconnected. It can't be done.
Well, the government's statements regarding what the devices can do are actually not quite logical. I mean, for example, they say the image cannot, the devices cannot store and record images, and once images are stored and recorded, they're deleted. Well, I don't understand how you delete something that can't be stored. And they further make
I thought it meant that when the person left the screening area, the image was deleted. Isn't that what happens?
Yes.
Once you're cleared, the image is gone.
They're removed from temporary storage, but this is the problem. The devices are designed, they have the capability to save the image and to export the image.
Right, but the government says that's not happening. I mean, what do we do with those? You have one view, they have another view. What do we do with that?
Well, no, they agree. It could happen, but the government says it's not happening, and you don't know whether it's happening.
Well, to the extent that we've been able to determine what the government is doing, each revelation suggests that more of it is happening than they had originally conceded.
Well, just to pursue that question, so is it your position that the problem here is as a risk that images will be kept, or do you think actually that's happening?
We know that it's happening, in fact, because in a separate FOIA matter that we cite in our brief, we've requested 2,000 of these images that the agency concedes that it has. These are the unfiltered images generated by the devices that it hasn't provided to us. But you see, the problem is not just the theory.
Explain that. Say, what haven't they given you? I mean, these are images that they've collected from passengers?
No, these are images that they've generated through their testing. And
oh, yeah, that's a different point. I mean, my question is, do you have evidence that contrary to what the government says, that these images are in fact being preserved?
At this time, we don't have evidence that those images have been obtained in the airports. But we do know by examining the procurement specifications that it literally requires only flipping a switch. I mean, that's what's involved here, and that's also in the record at 251. It describes the functionality of the devices and the ability for the TSA to record and export the raw images of the devices in the airports. Now, that's a separate privacy question that isn't adequately addressed by the display, although, of course, the display concern, I think, would be diminished through the use of the filters. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brinkman. The case is submitted.